Greet you again in precious, precious Jesus' name. So much to learn from him, and I have been increasingly impressed with Jesus. Just the many nuances. Brother talked some about that. Just the many ways that Christ reflected some of the dynamics. Just a couple things in introduction here that I'd like to mention, and then we'll see how far we get in our notes. A couple of you were asking for a definition of synergy. Weren't sure what the definition of that was. It is simply the working together of two parts to produce an effect that is greater than the sum of its parts. And that last part maybe not as quite as relevant. That is true for us. When we work together, we accomplish more than each of us could do separately. But we looked at God and us working together and how God does that. That was the working together of two parts to produce an effect greater than the sum of their individual effects. I use a dictionary more in the last 4 or 5 years than I have probably in the rest of my life put together. Just look at definitions, and I think there's virtue in putting things simply. I'm trying to grow in that. There's also virtue in expanding our vocabulary. I just want to tell you a little something about my burden. I'll share a little bit more about my burden. Brother Mark mentioned that it's not giftedness or talent as much. Let me tell you that, in my understanding, gifting is probably about this much, passion is this much. I'm not talking about, God has to, take our loaves and fishes, and God has to minister increase. And that is, I just really, really want you to understand that there's a lot of potential in your life. Rather than looking to some professional or somebody that's got it all together, I want you to take that away. Someone has said the biggest waste of resources in the world today is not all the food and all that stuff. It is the people who go to their grave with their music still in them. And I tell you, it's not talent, because one of the things that moved me to start writing these emails, start contributing some of that, it was the passion, not the talent. And I'll just tell you a little bit how little talent I had. So I grew up in Costa Rica, 8th grade education, and I say I grew up in the bushes, and I did not learn English. I didn't enjoy English. Teacher would say, you might be a preacher someday and you might need to learn this outlining and stuff. And just went in one ear and right out the other. And the first article I wrote, incidentally, was the month, the title was Facing Difficult Things. No, Facing Difficult Things, something like that. And it was the month that my son was excommunicated from the church. And so it was a very personal, I didn't share that in the letter. But I sent that out to a couple brothers to review, my local team, another couple brothers. And one of the brothers sent it back and said, there's paragraphs in the introduction, but none afterwards. Was that corrupted in the email somehow, or? Oops. So I called Jaden. He's a school teacher and on the ministry team there. And I asked him, exactly what's a paragraph consist of? That's where I was. So if there's hope for me, there's hope for you. I just encourage you, and I especially would encourage you older brothers to write down some things. God's people deserve to be led well is my motto. Turn the Bibles to John 13, especially looking at healthy perspectives on conflict. Conflict is not an end in itself. It is a means to an end. It is a vehicle. It is a tool. I just want to read a number of scriptures here to give us a little context and maybe just the importance. We struggle on two sides of this. One is to be afraid of an ecumenical movement or something that you know, we just come together and we don't have the same values, the same, and then on the other hand, we have, we struggle with valuing other things instead of unity. We hold our positions, we hold our practical areas or whatever, and unity becomes, we don't really care about it. That's probably a little strong. But some of these other things trump unity. And I think somehow we need to strive to keep them together. Because a lot of things are lost on the wings of conflict. There's a lot of things that... So I just want to look here at some of Jesus' words in John 13, 34 and 35. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. And if you think of the... This is after the communion service and the foot-washing scripture. And then Christ told, was just got them telling them that he would be betrayed. And he would go. See, before, when Christ was here, they could walk. They could identify his disciples by those who followed him. They could see Jesus, they could see his disciples. After Jesus is no more here physically, this would be an identifying mark. You're by the love that you have one for another. Modesty is important. Separation is important, but that is not what Christ hung his identity on. The identity of his followers. And then just on a couple chapters over, John 17, is prayer, last prayer with the disciples there. I think we'll start verse 20. Need to pray for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me, and hast loved them as thou hast loved me. Just this prayer for oneness. You see, it's a powerful picture. The unity and community that there is in the Trinity. And because there is unity in the cause, there is possibility of unity in the effect. And when we are different, it's not, unity is not said of one thing. For unity to be the meaning of unity means different parts coming together and being one. You cannot sing, you don't have harmony by singing soprano. You have harmony with the different parts. Very, very important concept. But we reflect God to the broken world by our coming from different backgrounds, having different giftings and different perspectives, being able to work together at that. Philippians 1, Paul caught this vision. Philippians 1, verse 27. Only let your conversation be as it becometh the gospel of Christ. Christ said, this is how you identify my people. Let your conversation, your conduct be fitting with the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit and with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. Striving together, one mind, sometimes diversity is glorified. I believe realistically diversity exists and we seek together, not eradicating the diversity, but benefiting from that diversity. I'll try to cover some of that later. There's some limitations to that. Then on to in chapter 2, verse 1 of Philippians there. If there be therefore any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any bowels and mercies, fulfill ye my joy that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vain glory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. That is some powerful admonition there for nothing be done through strife or vainglory. It's a high calling. Then let's go to James chapter 3, one more passage. James chapter 3, verse 13. Who is a wise man endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. Wisdom. A wise man is a meek man. Individuals who are arrogant are not wise. Here's a little bit what happens. Little bunny trail here. If we're just accumulating facts, we become arrogant. But when I am 20 years old, when I was 20 years old, and this, let's say this represented what I knew, and out here, everything, this represented the boundaries of what I didn't know. So I knew this little bit, and I'd come in different directions, this was the boundaries of what I didn't know. At 52 years old, the boundaries of what I don't know, increased. How can you be arrogant? We have nothing that we have not received. Scripture says, why you do boast as if you had not received it. But if you have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. Can we preach it that strong? Earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion. And it is one of the enemy's tactics to confuse through conflict, to confuse through strife and every evil work. There's a lot of things that take place when their home is divided, when mom and dad are divided, when the ministry is divided, not able to work together. It's a right place for things to be happening that are ungodly. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. So we talked about synergy yesterday. You have God's part and our part. If there is not harmony, is it our part or God's part that's the problem? Do you believe that? Now let me just share my burden and then I'll give an outline. Our response to conflict has tremendous potential to shape the life of an individual, a family, and a congregation. And I had a section here, critical conflicts, that I took out for the sake of time. But when you get to critical conflicts, when you get to those conflicts where it can be a potential split in the ministry, in the congregation, slow down. There is tremendous effects hanging on this issue, on how you work. And the shrapnel, if you know what shrapnel is, the shrapnel of these conflicts have their ripple effect through people's lives and across generations. One of which is the Amish and Mennonite division. And we all know that there were legitimate issues in that. But the process of working through that conflict had probably about as far-reaching effects as the issues themselves. Most of us have been impacted by the effects of conflict. And some of these experiences have left an indelible mark on my life. It changed a lot of people, a lot of direction. My family, my own family has been affected a lot by it. People that I had a lot of confidence in. And you know sometimes how that is? You've been from one situation, you move to another situation, hoping to improve. And I don't know how many of you have come from a conflicted situation, moved to another church, year or two into it, you realize that not everything is well there. And after a while, we run out of places to move to. That's not all bad. People made some conclusions over that time, over that conflict. And it's just one of the big ones in my life. I know there's a lot, been involved in working through a lot since then. Some of them were done with conservative Anabaptists. We tend to think that the area or place where we face the conflict, that that's kind of like if we get away from there, then we'll get away from that conflict. I wasn't quite ready to throw everything out, but I was wrestling deeply, like, is this our fate as Anabaptist people, because we struggle with, we get picky about what kind of clothes we wear, what kind of cars we drive, is that the... I did some reading, did some studying, some on church conflicts, some of those were evangelical books, and for me it was a huge discovery that has left an imprint on my life ever since, and that is that it's not a Mennonite problem, it's a human problem. I tell you, brothers and sisters, you think you want to jump, make sure you have a solid place to land before you jump. You find that out there. I have read enough to know that evangelical churches face a lot of the same things we do. And so that told me that just ditching a lot of things, throwing a lot of things out the door is not going to fix this. And yet there was this, why, when we have some things where we do so much better at, we have such a better, more biblical position than what our Protestant friends have, why don't we do better in conflict? Why don't we do better in this arena? If you criticize without offering a solution, you're just complaining. What can I do to provide something better? Not as a provision, but what can I learn? How can I contribute to something better? That has been the journey that I've been on. I believe that we have embraced a divorce mindset in our Anabaptist culture. We think about church life and church commitment a lot like our Protestant friends think about marriage. And you're thinking, so you think I should be married to my church? Not necessarily. We just haven't improved ourselves as much as we think by all the moving around that we've done. Can we be honest with that? And let me tell you that being honest with our needs in this, our history is not very pretty on this. Being honest with that, being humble about that would be the first step. I'm not sure how to say this. But often it is what we have right that keeps us from seeing what we have wrong. We hide behind our strengths. We hide behind I'd be glad for your thoughts on this. I wonder sometimes if we think we have a culture, I say this is generally speaking, we have a culture that believes that because we have some things right, we have everything right. I call that a Mennonite bubble because it's not real. And I wonder if that is one of the biggest obstacles to bringing individuals from our communities, from other cultures, integrating them into our congregations, is we have everything they need and we need very little of what they have. It does not seem to make a difference to move the lines and change the boundaries to open it up so that they can, what you win them with is what you win them to. But our hearts, our attitudes, our humility about who we are. You know that most congregational divisions reflect pastoral team divisions. And what can we do? We who are called to help our congregation navigate the difficult and thorny terrain of conflict often become the source of that conflict. And I'm not here to blame, but just to be honest about it. For the outline for the message, that's my burden. That's what's led me on a study. I'm not good at it, but I've learned some things, been involved in helping some other people, and I see some patterns developing. And so I've learned a lot from others. I really just encourage you. Do you see it as a problem? Michael mentioned it last night, but do you see that as something that we'd like to do better in?
Yes.
So, it's not so much that we don't want to do better in these things. It's not that we don't want that, it's the things that we want more than that. I come back to the busyness. If you're going to do church on your leftover time, you're not going to be able to get deep into these things and address these things. So the outline, our view shapes our response, our view shapes our do. I just want to look at some of the different views of conflict. Then I'm going to talk about the nature of conflict, and especially looking at how those that are view of it and the nature of conflict, just understanding that helps us to not have such a simplistic approach to conflict. Talk about avoiding unnecessary conflicts, recognizing necessary conflicts, and then six practical helps for resolving conflict. We'll see how far we get that there. There are many ways to say this, but just got to say it one way. The number one is a black and white view. Everything, every conflict that surfaces is basically a black and white issue, a right and wrong issue. Simple matter of right and wrong. You are wrong, no offense, and I'm right. The person that views conflict this way will often be judgmental and critical. Not much effort is expended in learning to understand the other's perspective and hearing the other perspective, often accompanied by a superior attitude, if I'm right, you're wrong. Obviously, you and I know that there are issues that are black and white. That is usually not the problem. It can be sometimes. But it's when we try to make things black and white that we get into trouble there. Number two is the escape view. Conflict is bad, and so we look for a way out. I hate conflict. And so when we get into a conflict situation, we just shut down. We get quiet. We leave. No good ever comes from it. Never seen anything good come from conflict. Individuals who view conflict in this light often seek a way to escape, move away from the relationship. They run from conflict. Is it any wonder that they have to keep running? If it's your primary way of dealing with conflict, you have to keep running. Number three is compromise. That the best way to relate to conflict is to be the nice fellow. Compromise. To give in. Let's see if we can meet in the middle. Just, what do you want? I'll take a little bit of what, I want us to understand that there's a difference between compromise and a solution. Working together and finding a solution is a different thing than compromise. Or not always the same thing. This view believes that conflict will destroy friendships and is to be avoided at almost all cost. Compromise is seen as a way to avoid conflict. Individuals can relate this way in parental, parents. Let me just tell you that if when we take this approach to life, brother talked about discipline yesterday afternoon. You hate conflict. Sometimes it's laziness, but we hate conflict. And so a dad with a teenager that is not willing to address and go the places that he needs to and address these issues finds himself with conflict as a way of life. And the same conflicts. When we work through things, we will have ongoing things to work through. But when we view compromise as a way to solve conflicts, as a primary view, we will yield important things. Sad for the church that yields to popular opinion or majority vote as a way to avoid conflicts. Not only does compromising give away precious ground, but in the long term, it doesn't rid us of conflict. I want us to understand this. So you have an issue that you're facing. You're facing this issue here, and you, instead of dealing with here, whenever you face a question of direction, a question of do we change this practice or not. Pay attention to this. Never do it just to avoid conflict. Because all you've done is kick this ball down the road. It's going to come up there again. It's important. It's a concept that we understand that when you are facing conflict, you have, whether it's technology, whatever issue it is, and that if you just, in order to avoid conflict, you slide, you change the position, that will continue to come up. Number four is conflict is simply is. I'm just going to put is for simple. I'm not talking about strife. Strife has a little different part of conflict. That conflict is a part of life. Accept it. Accept that there will be conflict. Conflict doesn't mean your church is going down the tube. Conflict doesn't mean that you can't work together. Conflict just means there's differences. This view is a bit simplistic because at times conflict is caused by carnal ambitions or selfish hearts. However, just to me this has just been huge in relating to conflict. Realize that often it is the fruit of existing conditions. When conflict comes surfaces, it is the result of existing conditions rather than new conditions coming to the table. I use illustration in one of the last articles on conflict about a fellow, you know, people who don't like conflict. This fellow walks into his shop and he opens the door and there's this smell of hot wires. And he slams the door shut and says, I hate hot wire. I hate that smell. And I don't like fires or anything to do with it, so I'm just going to go on and do something. I'm not going to go in there. Pretty sharp. Why not? Result of existing conditions, and it's going to get worse, not better. You would probably, you all smart enough to open the door and go in there and see where that's coming from. Use that as a picture when conflict surfaces. Let it make you curious instead of furious. Let it make you curious instead of fearful. And go in there and explore where that is coming from. Conflict has many opportunities. Before I leave this, I just want to... There are times when things are black and white. There are times when it's better not to fight. Maybe it's with a neighbor or someone, and you don't need to fight. You don't want to fight that... There's times when we use those, but as a primary way of relating to conflict... It is not helpful to escape or compromise. To have conflict is human. To respond with grace is divine. I say that one of the fundamental prerequisites for living well on this earth is to choose your planet. Yeah? Have you heard of SpaceX? That's not where I'm going. All these church conflicts, all this, and I just don't like this. And so people run away from Christianity, and they run headlong into other conflicts. They stay out of church because there's hypocrites in the church. I'd rather go to church. If you stay out of church because you don't want to be with hypocrites in the church, then you're going to spend eternity with them. Maybe better go to church. We live in a conflicted world. Face reality as it is, not as you wish it were. And it will help us to deal with the reality that we have. So to have conflict is human. To respond with grace is divine. Now, I want to look at the nature of conflict. And all I'm doing is trying to help us understand that we do have a way that we view conflict. Is it the right view? Or could you be helped in seeing that there's ways of relating and viewing conflict that don't help us in dealing with the conflict? It doesn't make it go away by escaping from it. I'm going to look at the nature of conflict. If we look at, so we have, let me change this a little bit. We have neutral conflict. We have healthy conflict. Is healthy conflict a foreign term to you? Good. Good. So we have healthy conflict. And then we have unhealthy conflict. Can y'all read that back there? Very simple. Neutral conflict is, there's a conflict in schedule. It's an innocent oversight. There's no malicious intent behind it. It was just somebody overlooked something. There are issues of little consequence. Somebody picks their nose, bugs me. Or you would be surprised in mission fields how many of those little things like that affect their relationships. There's things that are neither here nor there. And then there's healthy conflict. There's differences in perspective. There's varied giftings. And those varied giftings are, and different personalities are given by God. And I did a study one time about personalities. I might get into that a little more. Are our natural, our strengths also are, is our personality, our giftings and our strengths, is that all the same? And what's the difference between spiritual gifts and our natural gifts? And some of that makes for an interesting study. There's the diversity of backgrounds that makes us look at things differently. So that we hear the same words. When I say church and someone else, maybe especially from a Protestant background, hears church, we hear two different things. Just, it can be miscommunication or a lack of communication. And some of those are not all caused by healthy. But just, there's just a big portion of things that come up that are not necessarily unhealthy. And I think our view of this, and when we sit down on a men's meetings, how we process that, soon as somebody, so we have some thoughts as a ministry, we lay out some of the things that need to be decided, and we open it up for input. Do you believe that differing perspectives are healthy? Or do you sit there and it's kind of like, if everybody says, yes sir, yes sir, yes sir, then we are good to go. We're spiritual because we're united. There's many different ways of illustrating this. I view this as a table. And we put all the information out on the table. And it just makes a difference whether you recognize this aspect of it. You're not threatened by it. You hear that. You want to, if a brother's thinking it, I want to know it. Shutting him down doesn't mean that he's not thinking it. Really, really good if we as preachers can get a hold of that. When we don't work through conflict appropriately here, it often becomes unhealthy conflict. Where there's backbiting and there is backstabbing, evil speaking, ill will and malice, selfish agendas, and personal vindictiveness. It is just amazing how that works sometimes. Conflict comes up and you haven't dealt with it over here. And now this conflict comes up and this over here is affecting how you're working through this. So the more current you can keep, the better. I believe it also means we choose our battles carefully. And I use that carefully. I don't mean in a political way. But there's just some things that are neutral. There's some things that don't make that big of a difference. They're not consequential. And if we, because of immaturity, we make a big issue of those. I just really struggle with this and just make a big deal about it. We're probably draining away equity, relational equity, that will help us in resolving the conflict appropriately. The more unhealthy conflict becomes, the smaller our window is to deal with it more difficult. So just recognize that. Number three is cultivating a culture of healthy conflict. Culture is a very interesting thing. Everybody has it. You don't get away from it. Culture is the sum of what we do and don't do. See, I can open up the meeting, lay out the issue, and tell the brothers, we want your feedback, we want to hear from, well, they know before I make that statement whether this is a good place to share their feedback. That's culture. That they know the culture with time. Maybe they don't know it the first time. We had a very difficult situation one time. We had and I won't get into details, but we had a situation where a name came up in an ordination that we as a ministry did not feel comfortable with. I don't know where you are at in that. We just did not feel at peace about it. And yet we don't make that decision without taking it to the brothers. And just kind of cutting short the story. We get to the brothers' meeting and we laid out what had happened. We laid out why. And yet we're not going to make this decision on our own. We want input from the brothers. A younger brother spoke up first and he said, maybe this is a dumb question, but why don't we just put his name in the lot and let God show us whether he's qualified or not? I knew that more important than answering his question was the dumb part of it. And I just told the brothers, I just want you to know there's no dumb questions here. If it's a question on your mind, on your heart, please bring it to the table. Other brothers answered the question. I didn't even have to answer it. But just be aware of that cultivating culture. Let's go to, I read that there in Philippians 2. I'd like to go back to that. Philippians chapter 2, verse 1, 3. Cultivating a culture. How we work through conflicts. How we respond to conflicts that surface in our brothers' meetings or in our conversations forms a culture that informs us whether it's safe to go there, whether we say so or not. Here in Philippians 2:1, if there be any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any bowels of mercies, fulfill you my joy that you be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord and of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in all lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. That passage is so pregnant with truths that help us. Is it hard for you to believe that someone else might have a better idea than I do? Think about that. How often do we shut someone down because it's dumb? Sometimes it is. I don't think he's saying that other people's ideas are always better than ours, but we are to have this attitude, and it forms a culture. I believe that the many instructions to unity and one-mindedness indicate that there will be differences to work through. We should strive for holiness in process, not just holiness in position. Some differences are innocuous as we work through this, insignificant. Some are healthy but need to be brought together, different perspectives. Then there are foundational differences of values or differences of doctrine and faith. And we need to understand, we need to be aware that as we work through conflict, sometimes things will emerge that are unreconcilable differences. Not unreconcilable in that we as individuals couldn't come together, but that we should not reconcile with those false teachings. I'll look at that a little bit more later. That's where some of that thing of strength and weaknesses. We were having an all-day meeting, and it was the first one we had, and it was just with the sole purpose of kind of trying to loosen things up a little bit. Some things going tight in our ministers' meetings, and we had one of the questions that we worked through was, "What are my strengths?" And we just asked each other to share what our strengths and weaknesses were. What are my greatest weaknesses? So each of us told each other what we thought our greatest weaknesses. And I learned what mine was, and it's like, so how am I supposed to know when my strength becomes my weakness? That's often when we say our strength becomes our weakness. There's a saying that I had used for years. If you want to know where your greatest weakness is, Now, if you want to know where your weaknesses are, look right behind your greatest strengths. The quote from Ken Sandy. In my study of the spiritual gifts, you see that in Ephesians 4, you see that in 1 Corinthians 12, there's a number of places, and almost always it puts a foundation, one faith, one Lord, and one baptism. And then it talks about this diversity. Not all diversity is good, but diversity that is grounded on that one foundation is healthy. And I concluded that it was not so much that our strengths become our weaknesses, but that we fail to allow other strengths and gifts to intersect with ours. When we fail to allow others to intersect with us, with our gifts, then, and we operate as a lone gift, my gift is it, and mine is a primary gift, then it becomes a weakness. It becomes a liability. We can be very gifted and very good at something and be a liability to our congregations. And just working with some church situations, and so maybe the lead pastor, the bishop is struggling with something. A couple of weeks ago, we were in this meeting and as we looked at some of the things that were happening, the dynamics and the communication and the lack of it, I just told the bishop that is, you will never grow fast enough for this to be resolved in time. Your only hope is to allow others to intersect, to benefit from the people beside you and learn from each other and not cover for each other's weaknesses in the sense of sweeping them under the rug, but knowing how to help. It is my observation that we like differing gifts a lot better on paper than we do in real life. Our physical bodies work together. If you want some interesting reading material, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made and In His Image and Pain, the Gift Nobody Wants, are three books that Philip Yancey co-authored with Paul Brand. And Philip Yancey be careful about his readings. He was a burnt fundamentalist. He credits Paul Brand with helping him with that and restoring his view of the church. But this was primarily Paul Brand's writing. It was a doctor. And just talked about how comparisons between Christ and the church and the body, how the body functions. You have bones. You have flesh. You have welcoming, soft. But then underneath of that, you have bones. You have structure. Without that structure, you're just a blob on the ground. And then you have muscles on both sides. In order for you to pick up something, somebody's got to tighten up and somebody's got to let go. Just beautiful pictures. Study, I'll let you dig into that. Our body has an amazing capacity to heal itself. We refer to it as the immune system. And that is it. When things are working, when this dynamic is working in a healthy way, there's just so many potentially big problems that go away without barely being noticed. There is a little video clip that I got a hold of that shows how the white blood cells take in bacteria. They go around this and they encapsulate it. They grab it, take it into themselves, and dispose of it. What a picture of Christ. On the cross, how do we know that he took it in? Because all the venom that was being hurled at him, he said, Father, forgive them. None of it came out, and he took it, and it's powerful. The God that made the church also made our bodies. And I believe that he made these temporal realities to help us to understand eternal realities. Study into them. Let me just look at a couple scriptures that have some directives on how to keep a healthy spiritual immunity. 1 Corinthians 13. I'm going to take time to read it. It tells us what love is and how it behaves. And it keeps a healthy immune system. 2 Peter 1:1-8, if you want to jot that down. I'm not going to take time to read it. And then Matthew 5:23-24. And I marvel at this passage because We are a Sermon on the Mount people. I mean, just of all the denominations that exist today, we are probably the most Sermon on the Mount people that there are. But there's a couple verses, and this is one of them that we don't preach on a lot or teach on a lot. If you are taking your gift to the altar and there you remember that your brother has ought against you, leave it there and go first and be reconciled to your brother and then go offer your gift. Has anybody seen that practiced? I trust we do that, I hope we do that. But I'm not sure if that hope is real grounded. I don't think we have done as well as we could have. Just the thing of coming before God, and maybe in personal worship, but also in corporate worship, and being at peace one with another. That is so powerful. Because when we are striving, God can't come through to us. When we don't have peace in our hearts, we go to a brother. So years ago, one Sunday morning, I was kind of impressed with this passage, and so I figured I was having devotional or preaching that Sunday. But I said, let's stop. Let's obey this verse. And we're just going to give you a little break. If anyone has anything they need to clear up before we move forward, we're going to just give you a little time to do that. Employee came up to his boss and gave him a hug and told him sorry for something that went on at work. And a couple went out and made some apologies. And just, maybe you don't have to do it that way. But it is part of how God intends us to keep a healthy immune system. Stay healthy as a congregation. Let me read just a couple of verses here. Ephesians 4, 31 and 32. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. And be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Forgiveness. Forgiveness is a very healthy part of our spiritual immune system. Unforgiveness is ammunition that the Christian does not need for a war that is not ours to fight. Now, there's some misunderstandings about what forgiveness is. Forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting. That's a passive process. Passive process. Rather, it's an active process of not allowing that to stand us between us and the individual. I think that is one of the biggest obstacles. When you go into a church situation and there's been strained relationships, forgiveness is so key in allowing us to come together. Someone else has said, unforgiveness is poison we drink, hoping others will die. Colossians 3, 12 through 15, put on therefore as elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercies, kindness, humbleness of mind, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another and forgiving one another. If any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. And above all these things, put on charity, which is the bond of perfectness. Let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to the which also ye are called in one body, and be ye thankful. Let the peace of God rule in your hearts. Are you in the middle of conflict? It's not a time to put off these things, but to put them on in double layers. Let the peace of God rule in your hearts. And by the way, forbearance is still a biblical command. It is a sign of great maturity to bear with the immaturity of others. To bear patiently with the immaturity of others, I think the way the saying goes. And so as we look at this, I believe we as pastors, and particularly bishops or lead elders, or have a responsibility to set the tone and the atmosphere of opening it up, genuinely opening it up, and letting people share, working through those things. You know, when you sit down and you ask somebody, well, what do you think about that? Sometimes we listen in about half a minute or less than that, and then we're preparing our answer, we're preparing our, and we stop listening. What did we say yesterday? One of the things that I learned is that when you ask a question, the answer should generally come from the other party. At this point, it doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong. I want to know how he's thinking. He that answereth a matter before he heareth it is folly and shame to him. Just a way of conflict is healthy. Conflict can be healthy, I should say. conflict, when we work through that, and we ask, we work through those things, someone has said that being heard is akin to feeling loved. It's just amazing what people, how workable they become when they are heard. Obviously, Christ has to be a part of that. Let me just tell you that businesses work some of these principles because it costs them money to have these kind of conflicts, unhealthy conflicts. You can be good at this and not have Christ in your heart from a surface perspective. But that is not our goal. That is not our, we're looking at coming together and the kingdom of God. We can build relationships with those we serve or serve with. If you as a pastor have someone that you struggle with, invest in that relationship more than the others. We tend to withdraw. We tend to kind of go over here. It's just easier to avoid them. Go to them. Make sure. I think it's sad sometimes when people are excommunicated in our churches. I hear of situations, and I have not verified that the pastor or the bishop had never shook their hand in a year. Make it a point. It does not matter how wrong they are. Everybody is a person. Everybody has value. You can shake their hand, be polite, and care about them. It'll make a big difference. Build a relationship. I believe there's some unfortunate ideas floating around about relationships. Some, in the name of relationships, compromise biblical values. We want to build a relationship with our children, so we're not going to spank them. We're going to go light on the discipline. Others are saying, I don't like all this emphasis on relationships. I don't believe it's biblical. I didn't hear this much about relationships when I was growing up. You probably didn't. We need truth. We need to take a stand. I believe it's the same thing that happened with the term love. And let me tell you that if the enemy can define the terms, he has won a significant battle. Love and relationships are key to the gospel message. And let me be very clear that you cannot have healthy relationships in the absence of truth. Neither can you have biblical relationships that are too healthy. For all the talk about relationships, we don't have more healthy relationships necessarily, generally speaking. Here's one of the reasons I believe that it is important that we cultivate relationships, not as an end, just an end in itself. I say that carefully because I think it is being in relationship to each other, valuing each other is important. But we need I call this the four C's of effective discipling. One is you have to have character. It's kind of a little bit of a bunny trail here. You cannot lead somewhere where you don't go yourself. You cannot lead others to places you don't go yourself. Being an example, who you are, will determine your effectiveness in helping others get to where you are. Paul said, follow me as I follow Christ. Second, we need content. Biblical content. You can be psychological. You can say things and try this or try that. But unless you're biblical and you're thinking about how you're approaching and working with someone, God won't baptize that. God won't be a part of that. And I think it's just really important that when we think about discipling, that we are, that what we share comes from Scripture, that it's grounded in Scripture. It's not just any content that works. And then we have connection. And I just bring this in because of this. If you have excellent material over here, liquid or whatever it is, and you have no channel to get that from here, point A to point B, that material will not do point B much good. And relationship is that connection that allows those values to transmit to another individual that we're discipling. And then the last one is commitment. Valuing them, knowing, Dale talked about that this morning, I'm going to enlarge on it. Takes all four of those for effective discipling. I encourage us to do things in our ministerial teams to help us connect. I mentioned that a little bit yesterday. Recognize that there is a contribution, things that we can do. outside of the times of conflict that help us to build with each other. Respect the fact that you cannot force a relationship on another. Having that respect, understanding that, will help you to not compromise or help you to not force the relationship. Someone has said that love can only go so far without prostituting itself in the process. And then we can create, talking about culture, creating a culture, create safety for honest communication. Light is so critical. When you think of conflicts, when you think of being embroiled in a conflict, light is so critical. Otherwise, imagination fills in. And can you imagine what happens when imagination imagines? Sometimes there's only the tip of the iceberg that's shed. They're trying to find if it's safe. Dig. What do you see there, brother? Maybe it's an issue with me. At our men's meetings, we insist on respect and propriety, but encourage honesty and transparency. And we struggle with that at home. I think it's partly my fault. Somehow, to make it easy for people to communicate. And so I'm trying to work on that. I find it amazing when pastors think that they can tell their people to shut up and think that they will. And I don't mean that they don't disobey, that they won't obey them. But just, people will talk. Assume people will talk. Make it safe for them to talk to you so you know how they... I would much rather a brother would share a thought or opinion, even if it's a contrary opinion or thought, at a men's meeting, and do it there where it can be addressed, rather than wait till the meeting is over and then he picks his people to do that. And open meetings are so important. Did you know that we can sin in our listening as easy as in our speaking? We can turn the messages that are coming in and corrupt them and put false spins on them or our spins on them. Listen to understand rather than listening to answer. And it will help you create a safe place. Avoid asking questions as a platform for sharing your thoughts. Just be willing to communicate, and it's a two-way street. George Bernard Shaw said, the single biggest problem with communication is the illusion that it has taken place. And then communicate with those involved. I am increasingly convicted of the need to have all the parties involved in the conflict. We go into these church situations and we talk with the ministry and we talk with the brothers and we talk with this. And there's a place for people to share that. I don't have that all figured out. But then you're supposed to go take what they said to somebody else, and then they wonder who said this, or it just gets, it's harder. But I believe when we, all the parties that need to be there can be there and be reconciled. I'd be glad for your thoughts on that. Number four is avoid unnecessary conflicts. Not all conflicts are necessary. So there's healthy conflicts. But as we go through church life, there's some things that we can do to avoid conflict. And one of them is clear communication, so that there are clear expectations. Make sure that we're on the same page. I don't know how many of you do it, but when you have brothers' meetings and you have a discussion and you make a decision, write that down. Write that down not because you don't trust each other, but because we're human. And just, here's the decision. And do we all agree that this is the decision that we made? In our ministers' meetings, we don't do that. We all take notes and we take our, then we don't really read them at the next meeting. And I'm wondering if we should do that. Just communicate. Be clear. Don't expect it because it's clear to you, it's clear to someone else. And one of the mistakes we make is we discuss this thing in our team meetings and we got this thing all hashed out. We may spend 2-3 hours on it. And then we go in a couple sentences, we expect others to understand where we're coming from. It's one of the mistakes we can make. As a rule of thumb, in church administration, leave surprises for birthday parties. That's okay. Another thing we can do to avoid conflicts is clarify how decisions can be made. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this one. Could have a message on it. I believe it's one of the weaknesses for those of us who come out of more structured settings. And we have maybe a little uncertainty and we don't want to be too heavy-handed and just, we don't clarify how we're approaching decisions. We don't clarify what's expected. Match your expectations with your decision-making. And I just want to give you an acronym for that. And I know it's not a word, so I get to, it's probably not pronounced right, but if you make up the word, you can make up the pronunciation for it, can't you? Seems like that's what's happened in our English language. So you have mandate. Four different ways that decisions can be made, and it can be laid out in different ways. Number two is ask counsel. And number three is count or voting. Number four is harmony, or what we would often say consensus, trying to come to harmony. So you have mandate, commanding, saying how it's going to be. You have asking counsel. You have counting votes. And you have harmony or consensus. Which of these is a biblical approach to decision making in a congregation? Harmony? What did you say, Dale? There you go. He's been around the block. I believe that some of our discussions, some of you have heard teaching on democratic, theocratic church government. My thoughts on that is that it's often presented in a simplistic way. Kind of what it boils down to is when the theocratic is the ministry makes the decisions and democratic is the people make the decisions. Maybe oversimplifying, but that is often where the burden comes from. And I'd love to hear feedback. I believe all of these have a place. Mandating is appropriate for areas that are scripture, clearly defined in scripture. We do not have the right, the biblical authority, to take a vote on things that are biblical practice, doctrines, things that are clearly spelled out in scripture. Head covering, for example. When in your congregation, when in a certain congregation, it is brought up to a vote whether we can wear the head coverings or can do without them, there's a lot more eroded than just that issue. Which practice you're going to use or what kind of style may be something that you take consensus on. Asking counsel. There are decisions where going away for meetings, we ask counsel, but we expect to make the decision on that. We're asking for input, but we're not using consensus. We're not using this approach to try to come up with that decision. And then there are things that are neither here nor there. A tent meeting speaker, a speaker for weekend of meetings. There's two mutually options that are mutually that are equal. And we take the highest vote on that. There's a lot of drift happened because of using this. On areas that are a lot more important and directional, we try never to use this approach on issues that are directional in the congregation. And all I'm saying here is that if people are expecting you to do this and you do this, it creates conflict. And if they would understand the decision-making process, we could clarify that more at home. I think we have a basic understanding. I have erred, I believe. I talked with my team about this. I think I did a little bit already. But when we had areas where there was some deviation, it was more than just one individual, I felt like having a discussion and talking about the principle would be better so that we'd all be on the same page. Not all wrong. But if you try to do all of church life on a consensus basis, you'll get bogged down discussing details to no end. Sometimes just going to a brother and saying, could you change this? This is not in keeping with our addressing those issues. We don't need to bog down the whole brotherhood with a discussion on that. Because it's not only our discussion, but also our practice that defines direction. It's key on that. There are times, however, where we need to be together. Not sure if I have time to go into this. Church discipline, to me, is one of those. In 20-some years, I don't say this as a bragamony. I just believe it's important. And I'll tell you why I believe it's important. When it comes to church discipline, It's maybe a combination, but we feel it's really important to be together. Now, some administrations would say that you have the authority. It's a clear sin. It's an issue. And so you need to mandate. You need to command. You need to say how it's going to be. Our question is not whether we have the authority to do that or not. Our question is, how are we going to use our authority? And we work towards harmony. We work towards coming together, hearing each other out. There was a situation in the last couple years where we had taken a lot of time working with this individual and tried many angles, came to this meeting, and I kind of expected the brothers to be on the same page. We had talked about this, and we went around the circle, and there was two brothers who felt we should give it more time. Kind of surprised me. But up to this point, we had not taken any decisions on discipline without being together. Doesn't mean everybody's would do it that way, but everybody is willing to support. And so we stopped. And we asked the brothers what they thought could be done, and they shared their perspectives. Without going into all the details, we agreed to work with them and give it some more time, give it 6 months, and do some of the things that they were suggesting, and in that process, clarify with the condition that at the end of 6 months, that would not be clear, there still wouldn't be clear that they would support the rest of the brothers. I know I'm leaving out details. I just want to share this part. The 6 months came up, and guess what? It was still cloudy. The individual had showed up for all his meetings, but his attitude hadn't changed. I literally did not know how this meeting was going to go. I just knew that light and working together was important. There are times when you step up to this. I'm not saying it's never appropriate. But we ran around a circle. And the one brother in particular that was a pretty good friend of this individual, when it came his turn to give his input, I did not know what it was going to be. He looked up, he said, "These last couple months have been very difficult for me." And then he put his head down and just started weeping. I didn't know where this was going to go. Then he picked up, squared up his shoulders, picked up his head and said, "But I think it's the right time to move forward. I think we need to do this." We need to be clear. But in our clarity, we need God. I could have not done that. I did not orchestrate that. That was God at work moving in that. Number 5, just briefly on necessary conflicts. In our desire to be peacemakers and relate redemptively to conflict, let us not forget that there are conflicts that should exist. Some divisions should happen. And I'm not talking from the standpoint of we wish it didn't happen, we should be able to reconcile, we should be able to come on a big biblical platform. But that is unrealistic to believe that if we always do things right, everything will turn out right. There is a reason the scriptures say, if it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. It is important that we recognize that. Scriptures are clear that the gospel will bring division, and that there should be no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. It asks the question, can two walk together except they be agreed? Commands like have no company with, or put away from you that wicked persons, are scriptures that deal, that reckon with the reality of living in a broken world. And it is, the reason I bring this up here is because if we don't relate biblically and recognize that fact, we will not deal with those where there should be a division. We will not deal effectively and redemptively with where there shouldn't be a division. I'll try to explain that. It doesn't mean that we are unwilling to be reconciled. That's not what I'm talking about. It is recognizing that individuals have embraced a practice, have embraced maybe not a practice so much, but beliefs, or they're in sin. And in our attempt to reconcile and not, when a brotherhood doesn't deal with sin in the church, it not only affects that individual, but it also discourages everybody else that is trying to do what's right. We need to understand that in relating to sin. That's part of what's given me the courage. Church discipline is a very difficult thing to work through. But if you look at the consequences of not doing it, it can give us the courage. If we carry guilt over relationships that should not be reconciled, and again, it's not that we don't want it to be reconciled, but where there is people embracing sin in their lives, that it will cripple us. When we fail to respect this reality, we tend to carry guilt over relationships that should not be reconciled, hindering our ability to relate to those who should be reconciled. It is appropriate to grieve over broken relationships and desire reconciliation. However, we should avoid the mindset that believes if we do everything right, everything will turn out right. I would especially urge us to be careful in an area that I think has been difficult for us to think through biblically. To be objective about individuals who are not under biblical authority, who launch out on their own and try to do something different, and they look for someone to rubber stamp their idea or their work. I think we just need to be wise about that, because it can sow seed that won't bring a good harvest. You know, it tends to happen. It happens in constituencies. It happens in constituencies. It happens in conferences. It happens in affiliated groups. And it especially tends to happen where we have a personal grievance with the administration where they come from. You can just watch that and see how that works. 5 minutes to deal with practical helps for resolving conflict. I want you to have hope. If you are in a conflict in your team and your congregation, I want you to have hope. God can do something there that's precious. But hope is not a strategy. You need more than hope. You need to take concrete steps. I'm just going to mention these quickly. Matthew 7 says, get the log out of your own eye. I call it the logging principle. A beam mote versus a mote beam perspective. Consider yourself first, always. In any conflict that you face, consider your contribution. I look at it this way. I don't always do it first. But the more responsibility you have in a conflict, the more you can do about it. Do you want to resolve the conflict, or do you want to blame? Do you want to be the right one, or do you want to resolve the conflict? There is a principle in verse 2 of Matthew 7 that what judgment ye meet will be measured to you again. That's a law. It doesn't matter what kind of administration you have, what you're committed not to do, you'll not get around that law. That if you as a pastor relate from a beam mote perspective, a mote beam perspective, I've got the little problem, you've got the big problem, that we will reap that from the people that we serve. It's a powerful principle. And you know, we get these letters sometimes, we're working through a situation, and somebody wants to share their part, share their heart, help us understand the conflict. And there is this, I know I've not done everything right. But the rest of the page, a page and a half, tells about what everybody else has done wrong. That's a mote beam perspective. And they reap what they sow. It's just a powerful, it creates a culture in our congregations. And let me just say that this thing of, no, that's a bunny trail. Michael said they go stay ahead anyways. Here's an exception. Identify the issue. One of the things that I try to do, both at home and just becoming clearer to me, is one is identify the problem. A problem well-defined is a problem half-solved. If you are facing something, you have conflict in the team, and you're strained and stuff, take some time. Pray first. God needs to be in this. God will do things that you can never do by asking the right questions. But identify what the problem is. You know it's sad when congregations divide. But you know what I believe is even sadder? When they divide and they're not sure why they divided. What is the problem? And do you see, one of the things, and if you're helping another team work through this, one of the reasons this is important is because if you want to help them with their problem, they need to take ownership of that. It doesn't matter how well you think you see the problem, they need to take ownership for that. And I think it's a good way, just what is the problem? What is the issue? And number two is, why is it a problem? What's happening? What are the things that are we're not able to communicate? And the number three is, what's the solution? Identify the problem. What is the problem? And what would this look like if it was solved? And then how do we go about, what are some steps that we can take without solving it? I just find it amazing. And I have been involved in committee work, and I don't know if bishop committees have been, or ministers, some of those committees have been much more successful than financial committees. I believe it's our responsibility to go in and help the body rather than, you have tried it, and obviously it's not worked, so if you promised, everybody raise their hand, promise that they will do as we say, and if you don't like what we say, you'll move away. I just haven't seen much. What is the solution? We don't have a magic wand to make this work. Unless you're committed to make it work, it's not going to work. And to get that commitment by working through that process and not short-circuiting that, make sure you see it straight before you try to set it straight. Just a couple things. Every conflict has surface issues and below the surface issues. It has its fruit and it has its root. Just be aware of that. So when you see a certain fruit, try to identify its root. Not always easy. Sometimes we need God's help to look at that. But just a couple things to look for. A disproportionate gap between what happened and someone's response to it is a clue to something deeper. Look for starting points. Where did this start? Where did this first surface? Those are clues to the root issues. Look for patterns. Patterns give us a clue to systemic issues. Something that causes this thing to come up again and again. And then agree on the problem and commit to its solution. I think it's important. Sometimes people come in and help us, and by the time they leave, while we're trying to do this and trying to do that, and there's not commitment to follow through, that is a lot of problems with that. Last but not least, faithfulness is obedience, not only a resolution. It doesn't matter how the conflict goes, we can be faithful, regardless of how it turns out. It doesn't matter how the resolution, whether we agree with it or not, there is not a conflict that we go through that we cannot become out better and more mature if we respond right. Very incomplete discourse, but I hope it has whetted your appetite to study, to learn, to grow, because conflict provides unique opportunities to grow. I believe the enemy knows this and tries to wrest these opportunities out of our hands. There's a problem. Often is in conflict. This is the picture that comes to my mind. There's a black widow. How many of you know what a black widow spider is? Okay, you have them in here too? There's a black widow, the spider, and a black widow spider in the couch. It's not a good thing to have in the house, especially if you have children crawling on the couches. There must be more. If there's one spider, there's going to be more. I cannot be around this. And so in an attempt to get rid of the spider, the couch goes out. The whole couch is carried out. And now there's no place to sit. That is a picture of what often happens. If we're not careful and spirit-led in how we deal with conflict, valuable things go out with the issue that we want to deal with. Be careful about that. God give you grace and wisdom and bless you where you're at. If you're in the middle of a conflict, why not go home, get on your knees, ask for God's presence. Look for where you can humble yourself, where you can be an example, where you can open yourself up. You go first, especially if you're leading out in the team. You go first and ask, open yourself, see what you've done, and open and at least find out what the problems are rather than a lot of darkness. God bless you.